It's about 6:05, March 5th, 2012. Tonight, the Capital Investment Committee is going to hear from Department of Military Affairs, Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Employment and Economic Development, Public Facilities Authority, and the Housing Finance Authority. So a good long agenda. And let's see. Ms. Palmer, do you want to talk a little bit about Friday or Thursday? We're making a day trip on Friday, I believe, right?
Yes,
correct. Would you help?
Correct. Chair, okay. Members of the committee, on Friday morning, we will be taking a stop to the University of Minnesota to go tour their power plant proposal. The group will be leaving the state capitol at 7:30 in the morning to arrive at the U of M campus at 8 in the morning. We will be coming back to the state capitol by 10 a.m. And then again in the afternoon, we will leave the state capitol at 12:30, I believe, to head over to Dakota County Technical College, where we will tour their proposal. And from there, we will head on over to the Minnesota Zoo and look at their capital investment project. And hopefully be back at the state capitol between 4 and 4:30 in the afternoon.
Okay. Thank you, and we'll be sending a note out to that effect. So why don't we start with the Department of Military Affairs. We've got a number of witnesses. They're all welcome, and thank you very much. Thank you, General, for being here this evening. Appreciate your attendance. You give your name, and you can commence your testimony. We welcome you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. I'll be doing the lead-in, and I'll be joined in testimony with Colonel Bruce Jensen, who's our Construction and Facilities Maintenance Officer for the Army National Guard. We also have with us to answer questions should they come up, Colonel Scott St. Sauver, who is the Camp Ripley Commander, who really has most of the background information about the benefit that one of the proposals that we bring before you today will have. And I know we're on a tight timeline, so I'm going to turn it right over to Colonel Jensen to begin the presentation.
Welcome, Colonel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Mr. Curry indicated, I'm Bruce Jensen, the Construction Facilities Management Officer for the Army National Guard. There is a packet of slides that I believe is in your read-ahead that will form the basis for the information that I'm going to provide to you. Looking at the agenda, there's a number of points that I wanted to touch base with you. We'll talk a little bit and give you an overview of the facility footprint of the Army National Guard, touch on our asset preservation or capital improvement strategy, and lead into the specifics of our budget request, primarily the asset preservation, and then rounding that out with the request for the Education Center Complex addition at Camp Ripley. If you can see in your slides, the footprint gives you an idea of the facilities that we're located in. We've got 63 spread across the state, varying in age from the oldest is 1912. The newest is just coming online this past year at Arden Hills. Roughly about 1.8 million square feet in the armory space, and that's primarily where the asset preservation money is used. As we look at our long-range capital goals, the slide in there has five bullets. There's really three main ones that I'd like to touch on. The asset preservation is the workhorse, at least in the armory, that's paired up with federal dollars to maintain our armory facilities across the state. And what we strive to do is maintain those buildings, and we do that through what we call batch projects. That's major building maintenance and modernization type systems in there. With the number of facilities that we have and looking at the life cycle for roofs, heat systems, and those types of things, we try to get to five or six batch projects during a normal biennium, and that allows us to get to all of our armories in about a 25-year period. We'll do envelope protection type issues, maintenance on mechanical systems, heat systems, windows, and then we'll also look at life safety and those types of things. A number of the buildings require some level of abatement when we go into new projects. And then also American Disability Act compliance issues, as well as sprinkler systems and those types of things. So that's covered under the health safety, which is part of the asset preservation request. The third bullet on there that I wanted to touch on is investing in the infrastructure and capabilities at Camp Ripley. Camp Ripley is the primary training location in the state for the Minnesota Army National Guards, as well as the Air National Guard, but it also is a significant training center for many of our interagency partners between public safety, Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources, and also a number of county and local law enforcement agencies. So a considerable amount of use up there on an annual basis with our training facilities up there. The slide that I'm looking at right now just gives you an idea on projected and recent batch projects that we've done. Obviously, some of these names are familiar because they're what we asked for funding in past bienniums. In FY 10 or 11, you'll see Pine City, Renona, and Thief River. Those three projects are already under construction at about 75% complete on the average of those three. Last year, we received bonding money, so we'll be looking at Jackson, Duluth, and Cedar Street, which is one of our larger projects, are due to be bid this May. So they're well down the road of being designed or under construction. For 12-13, which makes up the request that we're looking at during this biennium, you'll see five armories, and we'll talk a little bit more detail on the next slide with these as far as the estimated costs. When we look at asset preservation, as I mentioned before, you're talking major mechanical systems in the building and those types of things and life safety. If it warrants and there's some modifications to the inside of the to make it more functional, we'll look at those as well. But primary purpose is to make sure that we maintain the building and keep it up and running. We've got Cottage Grove, Roseville, Austin, Chisholm, and Pipestone are the five that we're targeting right now. And as I mentioned before, we try to get 5 to 6 batch projects during any given biennium. The way we figure those out, because these have not went out to design yet, we historically look at batch projects, and depending on what we're doing in a facility, we have a pretty good average square foot cost of those types of renovations. And you can see on the spreadsheet there what we're looking at for the estimated cost of these projects. And the square foot cost will vary some depending on what we're actually doing. If it's major HVAC systems, a roof, and those types of things, the square foot cost will vary. You can see that it's about a $9 million price tag right now. What we'll do is look at bid savings or other areas to try and to get to that point. At the end of the day, we'll use the money that is appropriated to work through these some projects, and if we can't get to those, we'll move those up to the next biennium request. The next slide talks about the Camp Ripley Education Center Complex addition. The request is for $19.5 million, and essentially what that does is cover three needs that we have at Camp Ripley through the addition of classroom space, billeting or lodging facilities, and also a centralized dining facility for the post. When we look at the classroom addition, essentially what we're looking at there is additional classroom for 200 personnel. This project would be attached to the existing education center. I believe a number of you were up last fall and actually looked at that specifically. So we'd be looking at about a 200-person classroom addition. When it comes to the lodging, there'll be a project in there to do a portion of it will be 40 additional rooms. Those are separate rooms, separate bath type, educational style building. The dining facility, right now the capacity we have in the dining facility is about 180 personnel. This would increase that to a 400-person dining facility, which would facilitate moving soldiers and any other personnel that are up there training through that facility. As I said before, it's in addition would be adjacent to the new education center that we have currently existing, and it's right across the parking lot from the Emergency Management Training Center, which is being built and will be completed. I believe we're looking at the 11th of April is the groundbreaking for that. So that whole area up there would provide additional building for those facilities as well as people using the education center. Couple slides in the packet that you have just gives you an overview of the location in reference to the Education Center. One slide has a light green footprint, and that shows you where we're planning on having the addition sitting in location or in relation to the existing Education Center. I know the question has come up about federal match because the Education Center addition does not include any federal match, and we're asking for it through state bonding process because of its nexus that it has with the interagency training that we do. So there's a number of other state agencies that utilize the facilities at Camp Ripley, and we really have a requirement and a need for that right now. If we were to go through the federal process right now, the earliest we'd be looking at that project being funded would potentially be 2018, 19, or 20. So it's quite a ways out, and as I said, we have a need for that right now. Because when we design the building, it'll be designed to meet federal criteria, so what we will do is pick that up on the federal rolls, and we'll maintain that building with federal dollars in the future. So there is no tail for long-term sustainment costs on the facility.
Sir, Colonel, just
Mr. Chairman.
So if we build it, the federal government will handle its operation or at least its maintenance thereafter. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The long-term capital improvements in the roofs, windows, those types of things will be paid for 100% on the federal side.
Okay.
Elements that use the facility will pay the normal utility bill, those types of things through a nominal lease fee. But when it comes down to roof replacement and those types of things, we'll fund that with 100% of the federal dollars that we get on an annual basis.
Thank you very much.
In your packet, there's a number of backup slides talking through utilization and those types of things. Those were provided for additional information should you have questions with that.
Mr. Chair, I'll jump back in a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about how much utilization we have at Camp Ripley and why we think this is such an important issue right now. There are a couple of reasons. The first one is with the nearing completion of the Homeland Security Emergency Management Training Center at Camp Ripley that was funded by the legislature a couple of years ago, and we're looking right now, HSAM is looking at somewhere in the April timeframe for the grand opening of that. That gives us a capability at Camp Ripley that will really enhance utilization by non-military forces. We really see an opportunity for counties, which have very limited training budgets for emergency management, cities, and our own state agencies to do training at Camp Ripley when you combine that with the other resources that are available there. Because we see that as a state nexus and a very timely issue right now with that facility coming into completion, it really gives us the capability in a very short term to be able to provide the billeting and the dining facility and the classroom space that we think is going to be necessary to help sustain the training efforts that go on at that HSEM training facility at Camp Ripley. We're already doing a lot of training up there. As I'm sure you all know, the Department of Transportation does snowplow driver training at Camp Ripley, and we think that's very important. We also have a lot of DNR usage at Camp Ripley as a central location. They do a lot of officer training there. And, of course, the State Patrol has its academy at Camp Ripley. So there's already a very large state nexus. And if you do look at some of those backup slides, if you look at that classroom utilization, 25% of our classroom over the last 3 years have been used by non-military agents at Camp Ripley. And we see that growing as the HSAM facility comes online. So we think it's very important just because of that state nexus to fund this project at Camp Ripley using state dollars. The second aspect of this is, as Colonel Jensen mentioned, the federal process is pretty slow. But in addition to it being slow, you'll notice one of the deep bullets on that why no federal match slide talks about the MILCON late in this decade. We just got on the President's budget an indication that we will receive a project that we began seeking in 2004 to build a new headquarters for the 34th Infantry Division at Arden Hills. That's a $63 million, 100% federally funded project. That's approximately 12% of the entire Army's, not the Army National Guard's, the entire Army's MILCON budget for 2017. Our concern is if we go out and ask for an additional $19 million, we will actually be competing with ourselves and put that project at risk. So we really there are some real reasons why we wouldn't gain that either, because the Army does prioritize in their construction program operational needs versus administrative or institutional needs, and this would be seen as an institutional need, whereas the division headquarters would be considered an operational need because it supports an operational unit. So we have grave concerns about our ability to get this approved through the strictly federal process, and really feel that it's appropriate for us to come back and look to the state to do this renovation of the last project that we built using state money, which was the Education Center at Camp Ripley. And that's really worked out well for us and provided us a capability and an interagency capability that we just didn't have before. And with that, I think subject to any questions the committee may have for us.
Questions of the committee?
Chairman, may I?
Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, members, looking at the completion of the project, could you talk a little bit about the revenues that come in? You get more revenues, and there's obviously less cost to state agencies by using the facility. And talk a little bit about the timing of completion.
Mr. Colonel Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, sir, right now our timeline would be we've got the designer selected for this, so we would expect probably in the fall time frame to have the design completed and put out to bid. So from that point, you're probably looking at this thing being open and for use probably in the spring of 2014. And at that point, and Colonel St. Sauvre can talk a little bit maybe more about rates, but for example, right now, personnel that come in and use the lodging facilities are renting those at $30 a night. So that's a significant cost decrease probably from what you'd pay on the, I guess, local economy. The rations vary, or the dining facility charge
and those
varies.
And this is Colonel St. Sauvre. Those change quite with our contracting, but what we do is we allow the state to come in. Each agency comes in and contracts that with our local vendors, either our contracted vendor that the military uses or an shipment type of vendor. Our room rates are really based around just recovering our cost. So there's not a profit. It's just recovering a cost, realizing that the federal government picks up the tail on many of our structures. At about the same time this facility will become completed, our emergency vehicle operations course for the state of Minnesota will be completed for the Department of Public Safety and the Highway Patrol. So that's another facility coming online at the same time, as well as we should be completing about a 240-seat conference center this spring, which will also open us up to some of those conferences at the state and local level that can be brought right on the facility and facilitated right in the same area.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, if not, thank you very much for being with us tonight and explaining our program. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for what you do, what your service for state and nation.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, moving on then, Department of Veterans Affairs, Pam Burrows, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Good to
Chair.
Have you here.
Pam Burrows, Interim Deputy Commissioner for Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm going to start out for those of you that aren't familiar with the Minneapolis campus, and unfortunately, I think in your packet you have a black and white aerial shot and artistic view of the campus instead of a color one. But anyway, I just wanted to point out the resident care areas on the campus. As you can see, there's a lot of different buildings. Building number 6 dates back to 1905 and was originally the Women's and Orphans Building. Currently, that building we're home to 91 veterans and mostly Alzheimer's residents. Next to it is building number 9, or it's going to be new building number 19. That is currently under construction and should open hopefully in April, no later than May. That was the a building back in 19, I th- November of 08, that was housed 60 domiciliary residents, and at that time they had to vacate due to structural deterioration. Those residents went into Building 17, a 50-bed unit on Building 17 that was empty on the fourth floor. And then the construction was started on the Building 9. It changed to a 100-bed skilled nursing home. Then during that time, we did a campus master plan. We completed that in 2009, and that identified that Building 17, which is the zigzaggy building, was the most urgent building to be replaced. And we looked at whether that should be renovated or replaced. And the life cycle costing and energy model evaluation indicated that the long-term benefit was to remove that building and to replace with a new building. So during the last bonding session, funding was given for that building, for the north half of that building to be replaced, and then also for Building 16, which was originally, housed about 100 residents way back in the 80s and early 90s, and then was given over to Prodigal Heilman House, and it's currently empty. And that building will be remodeled for the 50 domiciliary residents that are currently housed in Building 17. And the north half of Building 17 is there in design right now to start building on that one. And that will be another 100-bed skilled nursing facility. So our current bond, and then the next page shows what we hope the campus will look like when we're all done. But our current priority one bonding then on slide on the fifth slide is Building 17 South, which is the third part of that 100-bed skilled nursing facility. Once those three buildings are done, those will house the 300 of our 341 skilled residents that we're licensed for. Right now, we're only handling 291 skilled residents because of the move from the domiciliary to the fourth floor of Building 17. One of the strong requests of the legislature in the past has been for us to become Medicare and Medicaid certified. And as we started that process and looked at that, we found out that Building 17, we couldn't get waivers even to start the certification process. So this will give us an opportunity to become Medicare certified in all 300 beds once this is done. And it would complete the renovation of Building 17. And it would also provide a quality of life that you know our veterans and our residents need. So the other thing is we know that we have federal authorization conditionally approved for $17.55 million. As long as we get the funding this year and can give them that guarantee by August 15th. If we don't, we go back probably into their pool of applicants. And currently on the federal fiscal year 2012 list for state grants home funding, they have 61 projects in the priority one, and that's where we would need to be. And right now that they're well over $321 million. And usually they fund only about $85 to $100 million. But we know that we're on the deferred priority one deferred by state to the fiscal year 13-14. So if we get the funding, we're very confident we'll get the money from the federal. The other part of this is a tunnel. part of this project is a tunnel, and that would go from the all of Building 17 into Building 9, and it would provide movement for all the supplies, for the materials, for housekeeping, for dietary, again, it's a quality of life issue. Without the tunnels, all of that would have to go through the main areas, and again, it takes away from the quality of the construction of the way this was designed to be a home for our residents. It also provides for delivery of the utilities and the infrastructure to support both buildings 17 and 19. Third part of this $25.42 million request is the technology infrastructure. With the demolition and rebuilding of Building 17, all of the centralized technology systems need to be relocated, the phone, the data, the satellite, the code alert, building management. And the Minneapolis campus is currently underserved for access to data transmission and needs to upgrade to fiber to meet the data transmission needs of the future. And only the capital build-out cost has been included in this. And this technology infrastructure build-out is required to support upgraded or additional resident building capacity. And it will provide a permanent solution for the entire campus. So that's our priority one. And then the next slide would be, again, a picture of our campus once Building 17 South is completed. The priority two is our centralized pharmacy. Building 13 originally was a laundry, and that dates back to 1891 when that building was built. That's been empty. It's been a storage building for a number of years. And currently the pharmacy is on the lower level of 17 South. The funding would be for interior demolition, remodeling of the occupied space. Currently our pharmacy is providing for the Minneapolis, the Hastings, and the Laverne, the pharmaceuticals for those three homes. We are bringing Silver Bay on next and eventually for Falls. The goal is to maximize the capture of third-party reimbursement. We recently started billing Medicare Part D, as we do provide the pharmaceuticals to all of our residents. Our ultimate goal is really to do remote dispensing from the centralized operation, and we're trying to work with the Board of Pharmacy to allow us to move in that direction. And we hope to put this in for federal match up to 65%. The third priority is our asset preservation, $3 million. And again, it just addresses the building repairs beyond our daily maintenance. Silver Bay, Laverne, Hastings, they're in need of a variety of building repairs, including but not limited to the resident room door replacements, nurse call replacements, boiler burner parts replacement, storage building repairs, exterior envelopes and replacements of windows and doors. And that is my presentation, and I would entertain any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Barrels. Is there any questions from the committee?
Chairman
Mayor Medson.
Just on building number 17, why are you knocking or demolishing half the building? Is it, are they built in different periods, or that doesn't seem to make sense to me? Why you take down half of a building if half of it's not good? Is
Mr.
the other
Chair,
half?
Deputy
Senator
Commissioner,
good.
Yep.
it was done in two parts so that we would not lose resident census. Minneapolis has a very long waiting list, and to be able to move the residents without dropping our census, we did it in two parts. So the north half is in design now. The north half is going to be demolished, and
the south half later on, Mr. Chairman.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, I didn't see that in the... Okay.
Deputy Commissioner, a question I had relating to the match on the pharmacy portion. Is there a deadline on that that federal match that you shared with us?
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions? Senator Wiegert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, how will this impact the waiting time? You mentioned there is a wait list. I believe it's at least 9 months or so for Minneapolis. Projecting if this is approved, what would that be?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually it will help because we'll be able to, with the completion of all of these projects, we'll be able to go back up to our 341 skilled population as opposed to 291. So it'll add 50 beds back into circulation that we lost probably about 2005-2006 when Minneapolis downsized because some of the problems that they were having.
So, Mr. Chair, if it's 9 months, correct me if I'm wrong, what would you project it would be in the after completion for wait?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's hard to tell because it depends on right now we've got 200,000 veterans in Minnesota that are over 60, so it depends on how many of them want to come in, and a lot of them want to come in. We provide excellent care. Obviously, it would bring that waiting list down as we fill those 50 beds fairly quickly. I would suspect that the waiting list would go back up again. But it would bring it down for a while.
Senator Wiegert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, finally, Deputy Commissioner, probably each of us had a delegation from Northwest Minnesota talk about the need for perhaps a facility up there. Does the department have a position on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, our position has always been neutral. It's up to you to decide whether you want another veterans home in the state of Minnesota. Our only position is that if another home is brought into the state, that we do not take from the support of our current homes to fund that home.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, I'm curious about your skilled nursing facility needing to be CMS certified. Is that because not all the veterans are on just TRICARE, or are many of them on Medicare also? Could you just explain that to me?
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, probably the majority of our skilled residents would be eligible for Medicare. Several or a lot would be eligible for Medicaid also. We don't accept any insurance currently right now. We get a VA per diem. We charge a maintenance cost based on a resident's assets and income, and then the rest is from state operations. So we were encouraged to look at that as another source of revenue to maintain our request to you to keep it more flat instead of going up. So that would be another opportunity to look at a revenue source. So the legislature encouraged us over the last several years to look at that, and we feel that it's appropriate to look at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any final questions for Deputy Commissioner Barrows? Seeing none, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Next we have Commissioner Mark Phillips from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Welcome, Commissioner. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. And I brought my deputy, Paul Moe, who will probably go through most of the details. You have the slides before you. And I will just walk through those relatively quickly. Our infrastructure investment in infrastructure programs are promoting a jobs agenda through strengthening construction and manufacturing jobs. These projects leverage substantial private and public investment They provide financing costly to community infrastructure, and they encourage redevelopment of abandoned and underutilized sites. So I'm going to ask Paul Moe to walk through the three different requests that the governor has made.
Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Moe, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Employment and Economic Development. The first program is called the Greater Minnesota Development Public Infrastructure Program. The request is for $5 million in GO bonds. Purpose of this program is to provide infrastructure for undeveloped industrial parks in Greater Minnesota attached to some business expansion. A local match is required. There's private leverage with many of these projects, and applications are accepted ongoing. The history of this the history of this program goes back to about 2004. We've awarded some 130 projects. 2,000 jobs or more have been created as a result, with $156 million of other public and private investment. If you remember, we received $4 million of GO bonding for this in the 2011 special session. On slide number four, there's an example of three projects, just to give you a flavor of the type of projects we do and the scope of those. The second program I want to comment on is on slide five, the Redevelopment Grant Program. Again, the request is for $5 million in GO bonds. And the purpose is to assist communities statewide to recycle obsolete or abandoned properties for new industrial, commercial, or residential use. This program is statewide eligibility on a competitive grant cycles.
Excuse me, Deputy Moe, Senator Carlson, did you have a question to that point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Moe, I apologize. I want to go back. The $5 million GO bonds, I'm guessing that's a competitive grant application type of process.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, the process for that is based on some criteria on job creation, reuse of the property, and other investment.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so would a project that looks like it promises more jobs rise above? Is that typically how that works? Or,
Mr. Chairman, Senator, correct.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Going back to slide five on the redevelopment grant program, again, this is to encourage redevelopment of some abandoned or underused sites. It's providing assistance for complex and costly redevelopment projects for industrial, commercial, and residential projects. Job creation, tax base increases are components of the evaluation process. This program started in the late 1990s, and again, we've done about 130 projects, some 9,000 jobs, with $1.5 billion of other private investment leveraged. Slide number six just demonstrates some examples of the scope and nature of some projects we've done. There's a typo, I apologize, on the Burnsville project. That's a $500,000 award. I believe your print says $50,000. It's actually $500,000. I just want to comment on the redevelopment grant program in terms of some need that we've experienced. We are currently in a grant round now where the applications were due in January. We're evaluating those applications and will make awards shortly. We had 27 applications received, 10 in Greater Minnesota, 17 in the metro area. Total requests from those applications was $10 million, and we have $2.4 million of available funds, including the $2 million that was appropriated in the 2011 special session. The third project I'm going to mention is the Transportation Economic Development Program, or TED, a program that was a pilot project with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. We made some awards in December of 2010, went through a competitive grant process, solicited applications from a number of communities, jointly reviewed those applications and projects with MnDOT. And again, this is a public infrastructure enhancement project that has some transportation improvements associated with some business expansion. That process in December of 2010 resulted in some 35 projects that I'll demonstrate in a moment. We were able to award 12 of those. We used $3 million of some general obligation bonds that we had and $30 million of dollars from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Those 12 projects represented about 4,000 jobs and $18 million in other private investment. Currently, I'll add that the Minnesota Department of Transportation has an RFP solicitation process out now, and it is, again, soliciting applications for this program. They have, I believe, $20 million available, and they've said that if this proposal passes, we would have additional resources from our department to couple with that. On page 9, there's a couple examples of transportation economic development programs that were done previously. On page 10, it's just a snapshot of that program in terms of the applications we've received and the amount of requests. On page 11, in addition to the agency programs that we administer, we are often asked to administer local projects approved. And I just this is a list of the projects that the governor has recommended for funding, and I believe the committee will hear some of these or all of these at a future date. I just wanted to just highlight that we would administer many of those. And then the last page is just a summary. We have $20 million of requests for public infrastructure to create construction and permanent jobs, as Commissioner Phillips mentioned, increase the local tax base, leverage both public and private funds, repurpose outdated or abandoned assets, and address some community development needs. With that, we will stand for questions.
Thank you, Deputy Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Moe, it looks to me like it's possible that you could qualify for a redevelopment grant. Let me see which one I have here. For the redevelopment grant program and for the business development infrastructure program. Is that possible?
Deputy Moe.
Mr. Chairman, the question, can they qualify for both?
Yeah.
I believe they can. I will have to ask staff for clarification.
But I think I'm just thinking of Floodwood in particular, and I know you've given them something under one of them, but I'm just wondering if maybe they, because they only need, they've raised somewhere in the area of $1.5 million, and they need a couple hundred thousand to get it done. And I'm just wondering if there's a possibility of getting two different grants. But I know we have a bonding request then also as a result of it. So I don't know if you've taken a close look at that or not. But.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, the business infrastructure grant we can take on an ongoing basis. We usually have grant cycles for redevelopment money. We're just ready to award our grant cycle that was done in January, and I believe the next one will be
August.
In August.
Okay.
So the timing might be an issue to do both, but
okay.
Mr. Chairman, can I just point out the last slide that I don't think we mentioned? We just wanted to give a flavor. Since 2009, this is kind of the dots would indicate there's a key up on top there. The blue dots is where we've done business development, public infrastructure projects. The orange ones are redevelopment, and the green are TED. Just to give a flavor for how this is a statewide impact.
Mr. Great. Chairman?
Thank you. Yes, fiscal analyst.
Mr. Chairman, members in the Jobs Committee, we heard testimony about the Minnesota Investment Fund, and the commissioner mentioned the governor might be supporting some new money there. But I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to how the MIF fund fits in with all of this infrastructure programming.
Commissioner Phillips.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jensen, the Minnesota Investment Fund we use for usually make grants to communities who in turn loan that money for job creation projects that are, and they're usually in projects where we're involved in a competition often with other states. And it's probably our most flexible resources for attracting jobs to Minnesota. And I believe the governor's going to recommend, or has recommended, and I believe he's going to try to provide a way to fund about $10 million for MIF, Minnesota Investment Fund.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Phillips, how many job training centers are there right now? How many are leased, and how many, are they all leased, and any plans for additional co-location with community colleges?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wieger, I believe we have 50 workforce centers, and I believe all but two are leased. We own a building in North Minneapolis and one in South Minneapolis. We are under, we're studying the ability to maybe work with a developer and convert the North Minneapolis one to a lease facility if possible, because we're facing quite an investment in that building there. I don't have the co-location map with me. I wasn't prepared, but we have seven co-locations with community colleges, and we're working with the Minscu facilities people and some legislators on developing a strategy for Rochester as well to try to do a leased facility with Minscu and Rochester. But we've had great success with co-location with Minscu campuses.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, while you're there, in addition to the collaborative efforts with Minscu and the higher ed, how about with the veterans groups and with their various training sites? Is there some synchronized planning that is done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wigger, most of our workforce centers is quite a partnership involved with local workforce investment boards are really the operators of the workforce centers. And the partners include DEED with job service, but they also include vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, the veterans training people. I'm probably missing a few. And then very often some of the local nonprofits also lease space in them. Sometimes DEED is the master tenant, and then we do subleases, and very often depends on the developer that we have a series of leases. So there's not one workforce center that's exactly like another. They're all different.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner and Deputy Paul. Thank you for your time. Next on the agenda, we have the Public Facilities Authority, Executive Director Terry Coleman and Deputy Director Jeff Freeman.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Terry Coleman. It's a pleasure
Welcome
to
the
be
committee.
Here tonight. You should have a handout multicolored that has green paper and blue paper and cover white. I'm going to go over real quick the governor's recommendation for bonding for the Public Facilities Authority, and then I'll let Jeff kind of explain the process of how projects get selected fairly quick and explain some of the sheets. But our number one priority very clearly is getting the state matched to federal U.S. EPA capitalization grants, because that creates our revolving loan fund program, which funds about 80% of the municipal wastewater and drinking water pretty much throughout the state, especially now that development has slowed down and developers aren't investing a lot in public infrastructure these days. So to be able to get the state match, get the federal funds, and then we leverage that with our AAA-rated bond funds that operate both the drinking water and the clean water fund. Our request for state match is $17,777,000. That should match the federal capitalization grants for the next 2 years, estimated that what they will be. At the president's current budget, we thought we were going to get about a 30% cut in federal funds this year because the House in Washington initially cut the program way back. And then when they looked at the program and the impact and the needs out there, they restored it and put in a slight increase in funding, less than a percent, but a slight increase. To demonstrate that their support for that. They might not like EPA, but they like what the states do with the funds they give them. That's, and the state match goes for both clean water and drinking water. On the next page on the backside is the state grant program or WIF program. It's the wastewater infrastructure funding program. We're seeking $25 million in the bonding bill for that program. And we distribute money two ways in that fund. With the revolving loan fund, when a city's operation, maintenance, and debt service exceeds 1.4% of the median household income, we start looking at providing 80% grants for the construction cost over and above that amount. So there's no application process for this pot of money. You just qualify based on the priority listing that Jeff will explain, and the financial need based on as-bid costs. The second way to access the program is with our partnership with USDA Rural Development, which also has a loan grant program. They have a formula that's kind of restrictive on the federal level, how much loan money they get and how much grant money they get. And over a decade ago, the state entered into a partnership with USDA because they were turning federal money back, loan money back, because they didn't have enough grant money to subsidize all the loans. So we worked with them. We match. They calculate a grant need based on 1.5% of median household income, and they provide 100% of the funding for the project once operation, maintenance, and debt service hits 1.5%. We match their grant need 65% to their 35%. And by doing that, we're allowed to use all their loan money. Plus, we've been very successful in getting one or two projects almost every year in the national pool because of that match. Their projects always come to the top because the state provides that match. They also take the very small communities, those that have the most difficulty and financial hardships, cities generally under 500 population, and almost all of them are under 1,000 population, and they have about three times the staff we do, so they can actually attend city council meetings and review invoices with the city and sign off on them. And our work, we basically send the check to the city. The city works just strictly with USDA Rural Development. So USDA sends us the payment request, and we process the payments to the city. So it's a real good partnership. It reduces our administrative costs drastically, and working with these communities also brings in some extra federal money. The third request in the governor's bonding bill is for $3,600,000 to the Lake Superior Poplar River Watershed District, and that is the Lutzen Lodge area, Superior National Golf Course area, and the residential development in and around that area. Currently, I think they're under a lot of pressure from DNR to stop pumping water from the trout stream that goes into Lake Superior, and the only solution there, because there really is no groundwater, is to pump water uphill from Lake Superior. So it's going to be fairly expensive to do that. And when you look at those two entities, Superior National Golf Course and Lutzen's Lodge, I mean, that is the economy in that county. There really isn't a whole lot else there. So to lose those facilities, it's kind of critical. So they do have separate legislation being proposed to create a water district, so it'll be a publicly owned local government entity that will operate that system. And roughly, also part of the, I'll go back to the wastewater infrastructure funding program because I forgot one of the projects that the governor recommended. There is $5 million of that $25 million is recommended in the governor's bonding bill for Central Iron Range Sanitary Sewer District. That's a project we funded. They're under a lot of pressure from PCA to go ahead and proceed with their project. We provided them the maximum WIF that we're allowed under state law. We have a $4 million cap per project. If there was no cap, they would have qualified for almost $14 million. This loan kind of makes us a little nervous because it is very high cost. Median household incomes in that area of the range is relatively low, so we've been recommending $5 million, which is a little less than the total they would qualify if there was no cap, but enough to make it a little more affordable for the local residents. So with that, I'll let Jeff kind of explain the process a little bit, how projects get listed and how we decide to fund the projects.
Thank you, Director. Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Jeff Freeman with Public Facilities Authority. The second page after the requests, and I won't go spend much time on the details, but there's a summary of the Clean Water Revolving Fund loans that have been made each year to date since the beginning of the program. You see the loan amounts each year, the average interest rate, and a comparison to or the discount from the market or an estimate of the market rate at the time those loans were made. Every loan we make, we calculate an interest savings to the community based on a very conservative estimate of what they could borrow for and what the savings of the program provides. You also see a breakdown of how the loans have been divided throughout the state by RDC region. The backside of that page shows a kind of a detailed breakdown of sources and uses of funds within the total revolving fund. This is a permanent revolving fund established under federal law, so all of the repayments come back into the fund to support additional loans. I'll just call your attention to in the pie chart, the state funds are about 6%, so it's a small portion of the overall fund, but it's a critical piece because, of course, it matches the federal dollars, and then together those state and federal dollars provide the equity that allows for the loans, the subsidized interest rate on the loans to communities. The next page gives the same kind of loan summary for the drinking water revolving fund. And again, the breakdown, the pie chart showing the sources and uses of funds. In that case, a smaller fund, it's only been around for about 10 years instead of the 20 years with the clean water fund. And then you come to the green sheets, which, apologize, the print is pretty small, but this is the Pollution Control Agency's entire project priority list for the Clean Water Revolving Fund. So this is primarily wastewater projects, but there are some stormwater projects that are eligible for this list as well. These projects are ranked based on environmental and public health criteria that are established in the PCA's rules, so it's an objective process of ranking these projects. You can see the column, the PPL rank number, and in some cases projects are divided into phases, so you see some fraction decimal points, and then you see the points that those projects in reverse order, the points that they get under that system. This list is approximately a five-year list of eligible projects that are in all different stages of development, planning, design, and then some that are getting ready to go to construction or that actually have started. In the case of the ones where there's a gray bar across, we've already funded those. The key to how the programs work, and this is really all of the PFA clean water programs, is the project priority, which is established by the PCA's list, and then the second main factor is readiness to proceed. We don't award funds to a project until they've taken bids and are ready to start construction. And so the programs are designed to direct the funds to the projects that are in priority order that are actually ready to go to construction, and there's certain milestones in the program statutes that projects can meet for the WIF program to have the funds reserved before they actually bid. In the case, as Terry mentioned, with the match to the USDA Rural Development, they make a funding commitment after the planning work is done, but before the design process has begun. And so at that point, we do reserve funds, and you'll see under the column that says WIF grant awarded or reserved, there's some shaded boxes where it's just that cell. That means we reserve those WIF funds from the previous bonding bill, and those projects are now working towards going to construction. We won't actually award the money until they start construction. The columns going across, I'll just point out a couple of the key ones. You see under PFA financing programs, there are the base programs, the Clean Water Revolving Fund, CWRF Loan, 2012 IUP Fundable Range. The IUP stands for Intended Use Plan. It's the federal process by which we publicly demonstrate what we intend to do with the assets of the fund each year, essentially the projects that have completed the planning work and are moving towards construction. All of the projects that you see with a dollar amount under that column are on the current 2012 list and moving towards, they're completing the design work and getting ready to bid this spring and go to construction. There's some CWRF principal forgiveness. The federal law does requires some of the money to be provided. They call it principal forgiveness, but essentially it's a grant. It follows the same criteria as the WIF program. And then you get into three columns that show the WIF program, our second request. The column that shows funds that have already been reserved or awarded. And the next one over is the estimated need based on the affordability criteria, the 1.4% of income that Terry mentioned, or the rural development funding criteria. You see the needs there, and then a cumulative total. These needs, again, this is projects that are in all different stages of development. So when you look at this list in comparison to the $25 million request, based on our experience, generally you can go about twice as far down that cumulative total to look at how far the money will go, because a lot of these projects these are complicated projects in terms of the engineering, the environmental review, the local government approval to give the go-ahead for a very expensive project. So all of those things, some projects are just, they have a need, we know they have a need, and they stay on the list, and they'll work towards doing that in the future. So not all of the projects will be ready to go. You can also see the Clean Water Legacy programs, the three programs that the PFA has that are funded through Clean Water Legacy Funds. You can see dollar amounts there, communities that have applied for those programs based for funds that were appropriated last year. And also we do a lot of coordination with other programs, and you can see the key ones on the right side of the sheet. As Terry mentioned, USDA Rural Development, a lot of the projects we work to match up with them, as Terry described.
Excuse me, Mr. Freeman.
I should mention that we coordinate with everybody that funds water, drinking water and wastewater projects and stormwater projects. We meet frequently. No one surprises us. If they go to one entity, we generally talk about the project. Usually internally look at who would be best, who could give the best deal to that entity and who should take the lead.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, how many dollars of requests versus the availability of funds? Can you give us sort of a broad picture of that?
Yes. This total list, I believe you go to all the way to the end, it's about $1.5 billion over that five-year kind of window of time. The requests for this particular year, the loan program, $279 million, the loan program has capacity to fund about $150 million per year, and we set a funding cutoff. The Public Facilities Authority Board, six state commissioners each year that look at the demand for the funds and the lending capacity of the program and set a funding cutoff. The last few years, that has been 45 points down this list. So we try to be real stable and communicate to communities that if you're above 45 points, this program will be available to you whenever your project is ready to go.
It brings up a point, is that we're borrowing more than we have sustainable capacity to borrow. But given the current economy, the prices, it's a decision that the board has made that they want to do more. Basically, construction is relatively cheap, and the unemployment is relatively high. So it's a good time to get a lot of these environmental projects that need to be done. But eventually, you'll see us either cut back or come back like we did early in the Plenty administration, ask for one-to-one match instead of one-to-five match. So so we can do more projects.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, these guys do a really good job at this, and if there was a place where we want to put more money into, this would be the place, because we require by law that all these little communities fix their wastewater treatment, fix their drinking water, and their emissions be this and that, and they got to go to these guys to get the money. And quite frankly, they would love to give more grants than they do, because the communities, well, I'll give you an example of my community, they don't have the ability to pay it back because of the money's just not there. And this is just a little stump speech, and I don't know if there's anything we're going to be able to do about it, but the fact of the matter is that somewhere along the way, we should figure out a way to get these guys more money and figure out how to get communities more money, because we're requiring the communities to do this stuff.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a growing concern out there, particularly in the first ring suburbs, where the sanitary lines and the water lines are really old and deteriorated, and what's happening is some of the sanitary sewer stuff is going directly into the stormwater pipes that go into the river, and I'm familiar with at least St. Louis Park and West St. Paul, and I mean, these are kind of huge expenses, particularly for our senior citizen population out there, and the Met Council doesn't seem to want to come forward lately to help us. And do you have, would your funds kick in the categories like that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, we can do collection rehab. Some of the work that Met Council has been asking for and the metropolitan cities have been asking for also have to do with the private service lines, because a lot of time, I mean, those were built when the house was built. I know in, like, West St. Paul, a lot of it's clay tile from the 20s, and, you know, when the city was built up. And I think if you televise some of those from home to the sewer line, you'd probably see earthen tunnels versus tile tunnels. So there is a lot of I&I. I know the Met.
I&I was the term, Mr. Chairman, I was looking for.
Infiltration.
Infiltration.
They were looking for, because you can't use state geo bonds to do that private owner, and it really is very expensive to go in your yard and dig that stuff up and replace it. So we funded it once, and the legislature provided some money once to the Met Council to help a couple communities out with the private ownership, and then also they've provided some money to the Met Council to do some of the collection system, but it doesn't seem to be a consistent program. But we definitely support their effort to get money to do those things.
It's becoming Mr. Chairman, members, it's becoming a major problem on the, particularly Mississippi River, where the sewage is running straight in, and we must address this and address it soon, sooner than later.
We can help the publicly owned side of the equation, but that's only a, right now, fraction of the inflow that's going into the sewer system. So.
And one more.
Chair, Senator.
The village of Mendota. We've been talking about that for 22 years. What are we?
Yes, we have, and as soon as they're willing to do something, we'll get it done.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coleman, did I understand you're retiring? No. Is that?
This will be my last legislative session.
Jeez.
But I leave the Public Facilities Authority in very good hands.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Friedman would be great.
Excellent staff, and Jeff is excellent.
Mr. Coleman has come down to the district. He's always been great about coming out and visiting these sites and talking with the locals, and I really want to thank you. I'm not sure if I was supposed to say anything, but Senator Tomasoni told me this, so I'm going with that. And you're going to be greatly missed, but Mr. Friedman, I'm sure you'll love it out there in Greater Minnesota, too. We'd love to have you down, but I do want to just say, it was actually a question. How can you tell if one of the cities is ready? Is it from the status column?
Yeah, on the Senator Rosen. Every year, PCA updates that project priority list, and they give that to us. And roughly about June, July, we send out, or May, it's actually, we send out to every city on their list asking them, are they ready, will they be ready to proceed with construction in the current fiscal year? And then we develop what's called the intended use plan. It's basically them telling us when they're ready. So.
Senator Rosen.
So, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it says they applied, they are ready, basically. Is that correct?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, actually kind of a couple keys to that, and this doesn't really it's a little complicated. I apologize for that. But one key is the column over to the left side, Clean Water SRF, or Clean Water Revolving Fund Loan 2012 IUP Fundable Range. The projects with dollar amounts in that column have completed the planning work, are doing design work right now, and hoping to go to construction this year. The other column that you noticed, the under USDA Rural Development, those applications, those are at the planning stage, and they are also trying to sort of complete the process. So it's a lot of pieces trying to come together, and
okay, that's good, helpful. Thank you,
Mr. Coleman. Yep, did you have one final comment
about the intended use plan? A lot of cities apply to get on it. We look at it almost as a two-year project because a lot of them don't get ready and bid their project by July. But once we place a city on the intended use plan, also from the federal level, we tell EPA that's our guarantee. If they bid the project and they can assure us they can repay the loan, that we'll finance them. So even though it's not a contract at that time, it's basically our guarantee that, you know, we have the resources and we'll fund it if you meet all the requirements of the program. So it allows them to proceed knowing they can get financing.
Okay. Mr. Coleman and Mr. Freeman, thanks for your time this evening. Next we have on our agenda is the Housing and Finance Authority. There's a little extended list here, but first we have Commissioner Tingerthal. Is that also, we'll welcome Ms. Flood, Ms. Matter, and Ms. Bakken, I believe. Nope, Mr. Matter.
Mr. Flood.
Mr. Flood. Right, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I know it's late, so we'll be concise with our presentation. I'm Commissioner Mary Tingerthal from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Just by quick review, you should have materials in your packets that we'll go over briefly this evening. Just by way of review, the Housing Finance Agency is 40 years old now, and during that time we've been providing over $1 billion of financing for low and moderate income Minnesotans, both for homeownership and rental housing. We do that through a variety of funding sources, state and federal, and we're very proud that the state agency makes the best use of those dollars by having a AA and plus AA1 credit rating. We are governed by an independent board of directors that helps us set our priorities, and do all of our work in the form of public-private partnerships with many of our partners who you'll meet here today. We have currently four strategic priorities that guide all of our investments. We have two basic priorities, comprehensive priorities, that are to finance new housing opportunities and to preserve the affordable housing we already have. On top of those, we then have two targeted priorities. One, to end long-term homelessness, and second, to mitigate the terrible impacts of foreclosure. If I can ask you to turn to page 3, our capital investment proposal is a total of $32 million, which was included in the governor's bonding bill. $25 million of that is housing infrastructure bonds that can be used to invest in privately owned but controlled affordable housing in communities around the state, and $7 million in general obligation bonds that can be used for capital investments in public housing. These requests are not for specific projects, but rather the projects would be selected through a competitive process. We worked very closely with our private partners around the state to determine what needed to be the top priorities for the use of bond proceeds. And we arrived at a list of three priorities, which you'll see on page 4. The first is one that I know this committee spends a lot of time thinking about, and that is asset preservation. We're fortunate to have a good bit of federally subsidized housing, both public housing and privately owned subsidized housing around the state. And much of it is 35 and 40 years old and is in need of capital investments. We think that's a good trade in that if we're able to maintain federal subsidies coming in, we generally leverage those dollars about 5.5 to 1. The second is to continue the campaign that we've had for the last 4 years of trying to stabilize communities that have been impacted by the foreclosure crisis, both through new opportunities and through community land trusts. And finally, something that we've used infrastructure bonds for before is the provision of supportive housing, particularly for persons experiencing or at risk of long-term homelessness. All of these are areas that the agency has selected projects for before, and we believe that we have that there are a considerable number of projects that would qualify for these funds should you include them in the bonding bill. We estimate that approximately 1,000 housing units will be affected by the use of these proceeds. On page 5, we talk a little bit about how these dollars would get out into the communities. They would be awarded through a competitive process, and much like you just heard from the previous speakers, that list starts with readiness to proceed, the leverage of non-state resources, whether or not they meet our targeted priorities, as we've just outlined them to you, and they must show a demonstrated need in the community where they're being proposed. All of the housing that's funded must be kept affordable for at least the term of the bonds, which would be 20 years. And there have been similar bonds to the housing infrastructure bonds that were authorized in 2008, and there has been no allocation since then. We have had proposals, but they have not been funded, so we really are urgently in need. We've completed all of the projects or nearly completed all of the projects that were funded with those 2008 dollars and have a long waiting list in mind. The general obligation bonds will work through a similar competitive process, but because those are public entities, we will run a separate process. There is no specific allocation of where these dollars will go, but the agency has a long history of allocating funds proportionally around the state. You look back through our annual reports, and you'll find that roughly 55% of the dollars tend to go in the 7-county metro area and about 45% in greater Minnesota. The bonds that were authorized in 2008, just by way of example, funded 7 supportive housing projects for a total of 400 units, and 4 of those projects were in the metro area and 3 in greater Minnesota. On the general obligation bond side, this was a light rehab program, so there were a large number of units impacted, about 680 units in 10 different projects, and in that case, only 3 were in the metro area and 7 in greater Minnesota. So I think our track record stands for itself that we do attract a lot of good competitive projects. We run a competitive process every year, and we get high marks from developers and communities for running a fair and transparent process, and we anticipate that these funds would be awarded prior to the end of this year so people can start construction very soon. Finally, before I turn it over to my colleagues, on page 6, we have a few illustrations of projects that either are the projects you'll hear about in a few minutes or similar to those that would be funded. The speakers here tonight will speak very briefly about the types of projects that will be submitted for funding should this bonding authority be approved. First is Chris Flood from Rochester First Homes, who will talk about community land trusts. Second is Kelly Matter from Common Bond Housing, who will speak about a very exciting supportive housing project for veterans that could be an eligible project. And finally, we have Deanna Bakken from the Jackson PHA, who will speak about the public housing piece. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Flood.
Thank you. Forgive me, I'm sick. I'm not sure how well my voice is going to work here. But my name is Chris Flood. I'm from First Homes in Rochester, Minnesota. And First Homes is the workforce housing initiative of the Rochester Area Foundation that was created in 2000 in the midst of a housing crisis as a result of the economic growth that had occurred in Rochester. At that point, there was such a crunch that people were having to actually not accept jobs in the Rochester area at Mayo Clinic because they could not find housing that they could afford. Rochester Area Foundation approached Mayo Clinic at that point to raise $7 million from Mayo Clinic and match that with an additional $7 million of funding from other local employers to fund a fund to produce 875 homes. We have financed a combination of rental homes, homelessness units, and also single-family homes. In those single-family homes, the Rochester Area Foundation Board chose to use the community land trust model to preserve the investment for the long haul in those homes and ensure that investment stayed in those homes and did not leave with the homeowners, but was reused over and over again. Initially, the demand was so great that we spent most of our time just producing as many units as possible. But as the demand slacked a little bit, we had time to reassess our investment and began to spend more of our funds on rehabbing homes in the core neighborhoods around the center of Rochester. Excuse me. As we really got into the thick of this work, the housing crisis began in 2008 in Rochester, and we realized that we only had a very limited amount of funds to address the foreclosure crisis in our community. So we chose to see the foreclosure crisis as more of an opportunity than a challenge, and saw that, in fact, the foreclosures in our community provided us with an opportunity to find homes that are very inexpensive and that are actually some of the least energy efficient homes in the community, take those homes at a reasonable price, rehab them, provide very reasonable housing for families in the community who are moving in to take jobs, and to turn them from some of the least energy efficient homes in the community into some of the more energy efficient homes in the downtown area. And we believe that with additional funding, we can continue this work, help to stabilize prices for all homeowners, and to provide additional housing for our growing community, which is, in fact, doing quite well right now, unlike many others. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You knew I'd have something to say. I just want to really commend First Homes in Rochester. They have done a phenomenal job of not only, as Mr. Flood said, providing the needed housing for a growing community in an economically viable way. I think the one piece that hasn't been said here today that I just want to add is how these projects have totally revitalized neighborhoods. I can take you to Rochester and take you down to the Kutsky Park area, and what First Homes has done here is absolutely remarkable. And I think I know you've touched on it, but I think that's one of the great things about this proposal as well, and is the fact of helping take some of the foreclosure properties off the market, which is actually going to benefit the entire market. Some of us sit together in the jobs committee, and we've talked about how our economy is going to be really tough until we get this housing market turned around. And I think this is one way, an added benefit of this project. So I can't speak highly enough for First Homes in what they've done. It's been phenomenal.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Kelly Matter.
Chairman Senjum and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. My name is Kelly Matter, and I'm the Vice President of Advantage Services for Common Bond Communities. Common Bond Communities is a 40-year-old organization and the Midwest's largest provider of affordable housing with services. We have approximately 5,000 affordable rental apartments and townhomes in over 40 cities in Minnesota. Close to 8,300 people call a common bond community home, families, seniors, people with disabilities, individuals who experience long-term homelessness. We, over our 40-year history, have committed and kept an unwavering commitment to providing more than housing by providing services for the individuals who call common bond home to help them achieve their stability in housing, to advance in school and employment, and to prevent hospitalization and early nursing home placement with the residents that call a common bond community home. Currently, we have almost 500 units of supportive housing and continue to develop new supportive housing units, and as we are preserving and rehabbing existing properties, adding units for individuals who have experienced long-term homelessness. And we do this because of our commitment to help Minnesota achieve their plan to end long-term homelessness, and we know that supportive housing is a proven strategy that works. You have two examples of potential opportunities that this type of funding could support that we're very excited about. In partnership with the Sand Companies, Common Bond Communities was chosen by the Veterans Administration to develop supportive housing for veterans who are experiencing homelessness. We will be developing 93 units of new housing. 58 of the units will include a historic preservation at the Upper Post in Fort Snelling. I'm sure many of you have driven by these historic horse barns and officers' quarters and seen them from the highway. We will be converting those to supportive housing units for single veterans and their family members. We will also be adding 35 units of new housing on the VA campus in St. Cloud. Services will be offered for all of the veterans and their families that occupy this housing and have experienced homelessness. Services will include employment coaching, connection to education, mental and chemical health, counseling and supports, financial literacy, computer skills, et cetera, to help veterans get reengaged with their communities. But most importantly, what this housing will provide is dignified, respectful, and safe housing with services for the men and women who have served our country and returned home and not able to find stable employment and stable housing. On behalf of Common Bond Communities, we encourage your support of this bonding bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Matter. Any questions? Next, we have Ms. Bakken, the Executive Director from the Jackson HRA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Deanna Bakken. I'm the Executive Director of the Jackson Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and I have two of my senators here on your committee. I live in Senator Rosen's district, and Senator Magnus is where I work. So thank you for taking the time to hear me tonight and to request the State Bonding Authority to provide affordable housing all across the state of Minnesota. The specific item that I've been asked to address is the request for state general obligation bonds to rehabilitate public housing facilities. In your packets, you have a map of the state indicating all of our public housing located, where they're all located across the state. You can see public housing units in virtually every legislative district in Minnesota. There's 124 agencies that manage over 20,300 units of public housing in 210 communities. These units serve the low-income and moderate-income people of Minnesota. The majority of our tenants are senior citizens and disabled with veterans, too. Governor Dayton included a request for $7 million of general obligation bonds for public housing rehab and in his capital budget proposal. Senator Peterson has a bill that seeks $10 million for the same purpose. Our public housing facilities have been very well maintained, but 57% of our buildings are over 35 years old and aging. Our operating margins are not adequate to cover the cost of any major rehabilitation needs, such as roofs, boilers, elevators, and window replacements throughout our buildings and for energy efficiency. The general obligation bond funds would be administered by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They would evaluate proposals from the housing authorities which represent the greatest need, are ready to go, and which leverage the most non-state funding. In May of 2008, the Minnesota Housing Partnership did a study on the condition of our public housing units across the state of Minnesota and the needs of our buildings. While the assets in our communities are worth over $2 billion, the capital backlog of improvements totaled over $300 million. Now, 4 years later, coupled with a steady decline from funding at the federal government, these properties and public housing assets are in need of state help to continue to be a viable source of affordable housing for our elderly, disabled, and veterans. Previous state investment allowed the Jackson Housing and Redevelopment Authority to replace an antiquated boiler system, which was original to our building, with a geothermal technology that provides more economical source of heating and cooling, will help our building last longer, and increase the quality of life for my tenants. The general obligation bonds will help repair and replace low-quality windows, replace inefficient heating systems, repair roofs, bring elevators into compliance, and help make public housing properties last for the low income of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and committee members, again, I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk with you about the need for public housing rehab. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, Commissioner, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for bringing your guests out this evening. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I did have a question. Commissioner, I noticed you mentioned land trust, which I assumed involves home ownership, but most of the proposal seems to be for rental housing. What kind of a breakdown do you have between supporting rental housing and supporting home ownership?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, you are correct that most of the focus of this particular request, because of the legal requirements about how bonding proceeds can be used as compared to appropriations, which we received in our budget last year, the uses to which the bond proceeds can be put for home ownership are fairly limited. The one use that is included here for the community land trust involves the purchase of the land, mm-hmm. which is then held in trust, and then that's matched with other dollars, either from the agency's other programs or from other funds that are raised by the land trust to develop the ownership housing.
Thank you, members. Just as a reminder, you should have received a note in your electronic mailboxes, actually canceling our meeting this